An inside look at the ICU during a pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
I did not accept the role of ICU director thinking, all right, we're about to undergo a pandemic.
The new series Inside the COVID Union from the Miami Herald and McClatchy follows a doctor and a nurse at Jackson South Medical Center through the pandemic. The film's director joins us. Also, is there another housing bubble building up? A new Florida Atlantic University study says housing is 11% overvalued in the current market. And finally,
when it seemed like the Star of Yiddish was really falling, there were people who are still planting seeds for the next generation.
A new book brings to life old Yiddish stories for kids. This program is made possible in part by support from the Miami Cancer Institute. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for joining us. Most of what we hear when COVID is discussed includes infection rates, mask rules, vaccinations, and the political scuffles. But ultimately, this pandemic is about people, like the doctors and nurses who are continuing to put their lives on the line daily trying to protect us, medical officials and their families. And these folks are at the center of the new McClatchy and Miami Herald documentary series, Inside the COVID Unit. It follows a doctor and a nurse at Jackson South Medical Center beginning last April and includes footage captured by healthcare workers themselves. Reshma Kirpalani is a reporter for McClatchy and making her directorial debut with this project, and she joins us now. Reshma, thank you so much for the time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You know, this project was really in collaboration with healthcare workers at Jackson Hospital South, many of whom, as people have seen the first two episodes, the second episode came out today, they captured some of their own footage of the pandemic. How did this partnership come about, and what was your original vision?
Yeah, so it's interesting to look back because I've been working on this nonstop for the past year, and it all started actually with an email. I reached out to Jackson Health and I pitched the idea for a documentary that took a look inside the COVID unit. And of course, the challenge immediately was how to show that because I was not going to be allowed inside the hospital. Obviously, they weren't allowing any visitors inside the hospital at that point. And so the original idea was to have the staff members film inside the COVID unit. And they agreed to it. So after that, it was just a matter of finding the right people to tell the right story. And of course, it wasn't that simple. It took a bit of time and pre-interviews and, you know, talking to several doctors and nurses. But I think we absolutely found the right people to tell this story.
And in finding people, again, some of the medical staff, they had their own footage from their own phones. But did you have to find people to handle camera equipment, or did you have to show people how to film? Because, I mean, that's an art form in of itself.
So believe it or not, this was filmed on their cell phones, which says a lot about cell phone capabilities these days. I mean, it had to be simple and it had to be quick because, you know, remember, these are healthcare workers battling COVID-19 in an ICU. So the last thing they're worried about is like how to handle equipment. So it was just simply like them pulling out their cell phones at the right time in the moment, remembering to do so, and then sending me the footage. And then, of course, when I went to go film inside the COVID unit myself, I had all the gear, you know, and was covered head to toe in PPE. And that was quite a feat to shoot with all that on. But as far as the healthcare workers go, you know, they were filming on their cell phones.
And, you know, I'm wondering what that was like for you, because now you're putting yourself in danger. And also you were talking to this doctor and to this nurse. And again, they're always constantly, you know, being in the front lines in danger. So, you know, what were some of those extra, you know, levels of protection you had to put yourself through to make sure that you didn't put yourself in that risk of getting COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was certainly aware while I was filming this entire documentary that, you know, there was potential exposure involved. I, of course, wore a mask and gloves every time I shot, and I would try to, you know, stand a bit of a distance away from whoever I was shooting. And the scariest part for me is that I live with my sister, and she is high risk. She has asthma. So when I came home from shooting super long days, the first thing I would do is throw everything into the washer, you know, take a shower and just make sure that I myself was not exposing her. And there were multiple times where I was not, you know, I thought maybe I had gotten it and I didn't know from where, but I was constantly taking COVID tests and making sure that I was negative while I was shooting. And taking precautions on the job as well. So yeah, it was quite stressful, actually, but very worth it.
You know, in episode one, you followed ICU medical director Dr. Andrew Pastuski and ICU nurse Julio Valido. You follow them throughout, but you know, I just want to introduce them in the first episode. What did they say about how the pandemic had changed their lives? Their personal lives, by the way.
Yeah, drastically. And this is, you know, you mentioned that this pandemic is really about people at the end of the day. And I agree. I think the numbers get a bit overwhelming. But I think the power of, you know, documentaries is that you get to really see and meet these people. So with Julio, when I first met him, he was already living in a hotel away from his family, because as you see in episode one, they had a COVID scare where he thought he'd been exposed to COVID and he thought he had given it to his daughter because she had spiked a fever. He had not given it to her. It was just teething, but it really scared him. So he moved into a hotel and had already been staying there for several weeks when I met him. And Andrew, you know, had become the medical director of the ICU several weeks, you know, about a month before the pandemic hit. So, you know, he was leading this team through a worldwide pandemic, which is something, you know, he certainly never expected, and then was also taking a ton of precautions to make sure that he was being safe around his family and decontaminating when he got home. So
and that's,
it definitely affected their personal lives.
So interesting that, you know, Dr. Pastuski, again, was, you know, he had just taken over that position just as the pandemic then hits. And here's a part from the film. He gave us this amazing revelation that he had hinted to the fact that he didn't know what was coming. Here, let's take a listen.
I have been there for 13 years, watching that hospital and the ICU grow. Here is COVID ICU. I did not accept the role of ICU director thinking, all right, we're about to undergo a pandemic and I'm going to lead this team through it. That was not the thinking at all.
That is amazing in of itself. But can you speak a little bit more to how the hospital workers were in some cases not really ready for this? And you know, what kind of things did they have to do and change to, you know, to take in all these people that were coming in and dealing with a disease they didn't know a lot about?
Well, that was exactly it, right? I mean, things changed very quickly. I mean, they reconfigured the hospital. They, you know, were learning about the disease as they were treating it. You know, I think they were just taking it step by step and doing what they could. And I think what we see in the documentary is a sense of dedication that they have, that even though they didn't see this coming and they don't have a cure for it and they are exposing themselves, they're showing up every day and they are battling this virus and they're continuing to do so even now. So
we're talking with Reshma Kirpalani, reporter for McClatchy, making her directorial debut with a 5-part series called Inside the COVID Unit. You can see the first two parts of the series. Part two came out today. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, you talked about, Reshma, how you get a lot of footage from the workers on their phones. And I'm wondering, like, you know, what was that footage like as you're going through it? You know, did a lot of it surprise you? Was there a lot that you really couldn't use? I mean, what kind of stuff were they sending you?
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, just getting the footage alone was, you know, reinforcement to me why this documentary was so important, because I was seeing things that, quite frankly, I wasn't seeing elsewhere. Things as simple as, like, you know, patients or them using FaceTime to show families their loved ones who were in the ICU, which was very important because, as you know, no visitors were allowed. So people weren't able to say goodbye to their loved one in some cases. So, they had that policy of using FaceTime. There was footage of how they were actually taking care of the patients, using rotoprone beds, flipping patients onto their stomachs. And then also there was just a sense of, a sense of family, like camaraderie is not the right word, but just a sense of closeness and togetherness that these staff members were all in this together. They were all battling this virus together. So, and of course the footage changed quite drastically as numbers went up during the summer. So,
yeah. There was this really, a lot of powerful moments just in the first two episodes. One that really stuck at me is, when you talk to the nurse, Valido, and, he's sitting, he can't meet with his family. He can't be with his family. He can call them. He's always on FaceTime with them, but he can't talk to his family. I'm just thinking about you personally as you're watching all this unfold, and it's affecting you because, as you said, you don't want to pass it on to your own family. But as a filmmaker, when you see stuff like that, these kind of stories, how do you not get involved and not let that affect you so that you could do your job, because it is powerful.
So actually, moments like that really reinforced to me why this job is so important. I mean, there were, as I said, the footage in the hospital was so important to see. And then when I filmed Julio not being able to hold his daughter, Emmy, it was heartbreaking and just reinforced me, like the world needs to see this. Like, this is what is actually going on. These are the sacrifices that healthcare workers are making to treat perfect strangers. They don't, they don't know these patients, but they're still trying to save them, and it's taking a toll on their personal lives. So it is, of course, sad. And, I have a lot of empathy for, everyone in this documentary. But honestly, it was just, it gave me a lot more energy and determination to get the story out there and why it was so important to do so.
Yeah. Here's a part from the second episode. Again, it came out today. This is Julio Valido, again, the nurse, and sharing some of his story and the stress that it put on his family.
The real heroes are the people that are in the background.
Good morning.
The people that are supporting us and making sure that we're okay to go to work the next day.
Here you go.
To me, that's my wife.
No, I don't want banana.
She's pretty much a single mom right now. And she's been doing it for a month.
Oh, look who walked in.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
People say, oh, healthcare workers are heroes, and all this stuff, but my wife is my hero.
Julio, he loves his job. He loves what he does.
I just got canceled.
You got canceled? Oh, because today was overtime? And I'm terrified of what he does. Night shift?
Yeah.
Okay. But that's not the topic of conversation when he calls, because I'm trying to stay positive for him.
Again, really just an amazing story, and following what life is like for this family, for both the doctor and the nurse, because they both have families. One of the things I've always found interesting, and I wanted, maybe you can add to this, is in people I've talked to in the medical field, it's that sense of, why did you get into this? And it's a calling. And as dangerous as this is, as contagious and deadly as this virus is, there's no hesitation with a lot of these workers that, this is what they got into it for, is to save lives. And they'll jump in there and put themselves at risk. I take it you saw a lot of that in filming.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. And we actually talk about that a little bit in episode two as well with Julio. It is a calling. It is a calling for them. And, the concept of heroes is interesting. because when you ask these healthcare workers, like, do you consider yourself a hero? A lot of them say no. You know, they think they're just doing their job, even if that means exposing themselves to a deadly virus. So it is, you know, it's very courageous and it's very special, and it's not comparable at all. Like, what I do is not comparable to what they do. But on some level, I guess I understand, because I also think that what I do is a calling, and, you know, was willing to risk exposure to tell the story, you know. So I guess it does have to be something that you're just kind of born with and really dedicated to.
Do the workers ever talk about, you know, what they see outside of the hospital, or are they even watching what's going outside of the hospital when they see, for example, like, you know, spring breakers going out there and just doing whatever they want, and politicians constantly battling over reopening the state and, you know, mask rules and all that? Do they pay attention to all that, what's happening?
I mean, of course they do, right? Because it's going on everywhere around you. But, you know, the sense that I got from them is that in some ways they kind of had to limit their exposure to that a little bit, because there needed to be a singleness of purpose, right? Like, right now they're dedicated to saving these lives and battling this virus. So, you know, of course it affected them to see and hear some of that. And, you know, it affected them personally because they're the ones taking the risk. But I think they just tried not to focus on that so much.
Yeah. How much footage did you gather? This is a 5-part series, but I'm curious, between the footage you filmed and what you gathered from workers from their phones.
Yeah. So I filmed from April to October. For the first couple of months, it was like almost every day, every other day, very, very long days, many hours. And then I was also getting footage from them, which I was getting on a weekly basis. And then, as you know, numbers go up over the summer, I was getting multiple, you know, videos per day. So definitely a lot of content to sort through for the series.
Can you give us a little preview of what the third episode will cover?
Yeah, episode 3 is like one of my favorite episodes, which I know I shouldn't say, because like... they're all good. You know, it's all important storytelling. But yeah, in episode 3, we continue to check in with Dr. Pastuski to see how things are going in the hospital. We follow Diane Washington's story after what happens in episode 2. And then we, of course, see, you know, when will Julio and Elizabeth be reunited? And what does Mother's Day look like during a worldwide pandemic? So stay tuned.
You know, as we gain a better understanding of the virus, you know, and more people now are getting vaccinated, I just want to get a sense from you. Do you feel a sense of hope, considering everything you've seen?
Absolutely. Yes. And you know what gives me that sense of hope is the healthcare workers that I've spent a year filming. I mean, honestly, their courage and their dedication and their sacrifice. I mean, as you said, they just keep showing up day after day to battle this virus. And, you know, despite the toll it's taken on them, despite the toll it's taken on their families, like they're really out there doing this and, you know, trying to help all of us. So, I mean, if that doesn't give you hope, I don't know what does. But yeah, I definitely feel a sense of hope.
And how are you doing? Because again, you spent so much of your time putting this project together, months filming and gathering footage, and then of course probably months, you know, putting it all together and having to see these stories over and over again and see that pain and that suffering. But how are you protecting your own mental health?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I think it's important to stay connected to your support system whenever I, you know, work on stories that are difficult emotionally. It's important to stay connected to friends and family and just make sure that I'm processing personally everything that I'm seeing, you know, when there are lots of difficult moments and it is quite sad. You know, I definitely have to take care of myself as well.
Yeah.
So that I can be present to tell this story for them. So I will say I haven't slept in like months and I am pretty exhausted.
Well, we're almost there at the end. Reshma Kirpalani, reporter from McClatchy. She has a 5-part documentary called Inside the COVID Unit. Catch the first 2 parts. You can find a link on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Reshma, thank you so much for the story.
Thank you.
And, you know, just a note for me, I just want to say thank you to all those medical workers out there and their families. You may not hear it enough. You may not believe it, but yes, you are heroes. Well, still to come, housing is hot right now. Should we be worried about a bubble or a crash? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. South Florida's renters and homeowners are among the most cost-burdened in the country. And as more people are leaving cities in the North and Midwest for our warm climate, the problem's getting worse. A new study from FAU finds the average home in South Florida is overvalued by more than 11%. And while there's still the threat of rising sea levels encroaching on properties, more people are moving to the region. In fact, many are even buying homes above the asking price. Is this a bad sign for the housing market? Ken H. Johnson is an economist at FAU's College of Business, and we spoke with him earlier this week about the study. The FAU study tells us that housing in South Florida is 11% overvalued. So does that mean that we're heading to a bubble or a crash? Is that bad?
It's not definitive. In fact, I would think it would be unlikely. While we're over the long-term pricing trend, roughly 11.5%, it's nowhere near where it was back in 6 and 7 when we were nearing 65% above the long-term pricing trend. This happened, so it's not that big of a deal. I just don't think we're headed for a bubble.
What are the reasons that housing is overvalued? I mean, what are some of the factors?
Sure. So at least in South Florida, there seem to be 3 driving factors right now. Number one, near record low interest rates are causing a huge increase in demand for home ownership. Another potential driver in housing prices right now would be the significant influx of population and expected influx in population coming mainly from the Northeast and the Midwest. We're expected to grow about plus or minus 750,000 people in the next 10 years in this tri-county area. And lastly is our chronic problem of inventory shortage. And that has a lot to do with the fact that we're constrained to the east by the Atlantic Ocean and to the west by the Everglades.
And so we have this lack of inventory. What's happening? Is it just they're buying old houses? Or I did notice, at least in a lot of places where I drive, we're starting to go vertical. Is South Florida going to start becoming vertical?
Relatively speaking, we will be relative to where we were. But to think that South Florida is going to overnight become a vertical city such as a Manhattan or downtown Chicago is just not going to happen. But you could go to West Palm, Boca Raton, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and clearly see the skylines are a little higher now than they were a decade ago. Another alternative is golf courses or open green spaces. So, but if we developed every golf course in Southeast Florida, that wouldn't put a real dent and the needed inventory increase. You're also going to see a lot of folks starting to go further north in these 3 county areas into Martin and St. Lucie counties.
And by the way, the other thing too, you talked about a lot of folks from New York and the Northeast coming down here. How much of that is because of the pandemic? Or is it just, I don't know, there's better value here?
Well, it's hard to separate the two, but this trend has been going on for quite some time. And a big driver of that is the weather. Another big driver is the tax-friendly state for not only, there's no individual income tax. The state of Florida is very friendly towards corporate relocations. So a lot of this is going on because of the economy, the historic economy in Florida this last 10 years or so, and because of the weather. But did the pandemic accelerate this? Probably.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, coming back to what's unique about Florida in general, but, you know, in South Florida, you know, you said we won't see South Florida become that vertical, not like Manhattan, because isn't that the appeal is living in a house, having a backyard? That's kind of why people enjoy being here, too, isn't it?
I think that's a trade-off, especially for those folks coming from the Northeast. It's, hey, I'm thinking of the house with the yard, but that will just become more and more rare as we go forward in the future. This is not going to change overnight, Lewis. It's just not. I see the demand for coming to South Florida to be strong for quite a while. The inventory shortage should persist. Both of those things will help prop up the housing prices for quite a while. And if you look at history, sometimes we run hot on our pricing for a little while in Southeast Florida, and sometimes we run a little cool. I think we're in for a stretch where we run a little hot. This doesn't worry me right now.
When you, as you said, we're limited by space because you have the Atlantic Ocean on one side, the Everglades on the other. So then if we're not going to build totally vertical, what happens? So we just start moving north?
There'll be more development to the north, in the northern counties, the counties immediately north of us. They'll just be smaller and smaller lots. You'll start to see perhaps some zero lot lines, smaller yards. They're not going to disappear right away. Other options would be in the area would be lower mid-level rises, some apartment living. You see very little apartment ownership here in South Florida, but you'll see a little bit of increase in that. But the pace of this will be such that we're just not going to see a dominant change in our skyline for years to come. We have a lot of space, roughly 120 miles from from Homestead all the way up past Jupiter. And then the width in there varies from a few miles to as much as 20 miles. We have space to develop, but it's still going to be difficult to develop today or in the future relative to what it was 10 and 20 years ago.
We're talking with FAU economist Ken H. Johnson. He's the Associate Dean of Graduate Programs at FAU. And we're talking about rising housing prices in South Florida. You could learn more about the recent study from FAU on our social media at WLRN Sundial. One of the other things, too, that's interesting is the flood maps. So these are changing because now the federal government's starting to look at climate change and sea level rise, and flood insurance is supposed to go up starting next spring. How do you think that's going to play in demand?
Anytime you've got an increased cost over where it was, that's going to actually impact demand somewhat negatively, but it's just being swamped by the demand for folks where they want the weather, they want the good business environment. They want to live in a good taxing environment. It's all pointing towards more people moving here. Will it slow down on the margin? Just a tiny, tiny bit. The interesting thing, though, about sea level rise, and there's actually been research done on this, that as sea level encroaches, as the shoreline encroaches to homes that are fronting beaches, you don't see an impact on the price until the very last minute. So even though you're going to see a little bump in insurance, I don't think we're going to see the potential for sea level rise impact housing prices in South Florida for any time in the near future. But one thing the studies also show is that eventually this will be a government-sponsored solution as opposed to a market-sponsored solution where prices will adjust because of sea level rise. The adjustment comes rather late and then it's rather rapid. So I just don't see anything changing in the next few years.
What, you know, do we have any reason to believe that, you know, the state's response to the pandemic and the impact that's had on our education system, is that, you know, impacting the desire for people to move here?
Again, you can logically walk through those steps, but we just don't see it happening. One of the things that Florida's in the middle of an experiment of, and we've been in this experiment for 20 years, is that we are trying to grow our university system to scale. Now, what that means is we're mimicking what California did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where they developed a handful of scale, large universities. And for 30, 40 years there, the University of California the university system was recognized as perhaps the best in the world. We're on our way to becoming one of the top university systems in the world, and we'll do it with scale. So that means we're going to have to use a lot of technology. We're going to have to be creative in our instruction and our research. But I think all in all, the educational system in Florida will actually be bringing people in to the state, not having folks avoid it.
You know, not a lot of bargains out there. It's a seller's market. The mortgage rates, how much are they playing into this right now?
I think of the three things that we talked about, the increase in population, the inventory shortage, and the near record low mortgage rates, the biggest driver of rising prices in Southeast Florida right now are the near near record low long-term mortgage rates, the 30 and 15-year mortgage rates. They're the best we've seen in our professional lives. And you just have people going out there about today searching for properties because they don't believe that they may ever see these rates this low again.
So, Ken, there's currently a moratorium on evictions, but that's subject to change any time. If it's lifted, do we expect a foreclosure crisis similar to what we saw in 2008?
One of the things that happened with the bubble burst a decade and a half ago, there were a lot of foreclosures. The number of defaults, defaults rise during this with the rescission of the moratorium. Yes, dramatically. There's no evidence to suggest that it will. People that are in properties today, the underwriting is much more sound today and has been for years now than it was that decade and a half ago. So you're just not going to see, for many reasons, we don't see prices plummeting dramatically. So people don't get upside down. They don't end up owing more than the property's worth. That'll be rare. You're going to see borrowers that are in homes that are more sound economically than we were, 15 plus or minus years ago. So will there be more foreclosures because of the pandemic than normal? Yes, but it shouldn't be such that it actually affects market pricing.
So it's a seller's market. Is it smart to be buying right now because the rates are low?
That's a trade-off. So it's hard to say. We're definitely in the top half of what's called a housing cycle. You want to buy at the very bottom of the housing cycle and sell at the very top. But guessing or estimating those points is very difficult. We're definitely above the long-term pricing trend. So that's suggestive that we're nearing the top of the housing cycle. Now, when will that come? Usually we cycle in at 6 or 7 year periods. So it might be longer this time, and the lower interest rates are driving that. I would think that if I was purchasing right now, I would bargain very aggressively and understand that there's always going to be another house. There's 6.1 million people living in this Tri-County area, and there'll be another property. If you feel uncomfortable with the price or the terms, walk away during the negotiation and go find another house.
And again, that's a conversation that we had with Ken H. Johnson, economist at FAU's College of Business. And you can find more about the South Florida housing market and how this can impact you on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And by the way, maybe you're out there selling, maybe you're buying. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on what the market is like right now. You know where you could do it? On our new Sundial Text Club. Send us your thoughts about stories like this one. All you got to do, text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's hello to 786-677-0767. Then in the future, you can tell us all about any segment that you hear. Well, still to come, Yiddish is having a renaissance, and we're going to learn about a book exploring Yiddish history as Passover continues. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Jewish holiday of Passover continues through Sunday as families across South Florida celebrate the high holidays. The week presents an opportunity for Jewish families to reflect on their shared histories. Emory professor and author Miriam Udell wants more children to be exposed to Jewish history and, in particular, the rich tradition of Yiddish culture. Her new book, Honey on the Page, A Treasury of Yiddish Children's Literature, translates a variety of Yiddish stories throughout history into English and provides biographies of the authors themselves. Sundial senior producer Chris Remington spoke with Miriam about the book and the themes behind the stories she chose.
So Miriam, you grew up in Miami in a Jewish household. Is it customary in Jewish Sunday school to learn about these stories, or do they sort of exist separately from education around the Torah, let's say?
Well, the stories that I translate in Honey on the Page have been mostly lost to us for the last 80 to 100 years. These are stories that originally would have been taught in the Jewish after schools of the secular left in America. So not families that were affiliated with any kind of a synagogue, but families that spoke Yiddish and wanted to pass on to their children something of a secular Yiddish heritage. Some of them do come from a more religiously affiliated domain, but most of them are from a politically oriented left that very much understood itself in contrast to religious Jewish culture.
And I think it'd be beneficial for our audience to explain the difference between Yiddish culture and Jewish culture and Yiddish as a language versus Hebrew as a language.
That's a great thing to clarify. So Yiddish was the fusion language of the Jews who lived in Eastern Europe for the past millennium. And when I say fusion, it combines a largely Germanic vocabulary with some other elements, including Hebrew and Aramaic, Romance languages, Slavic languages, and then that all gets written, when it is written, using the Hebrew alphabet. So it's a lot of different languages together, and it was the language of everyday life during centuries of Jewish civilization when Hebrew was really reserved for prayer and study as a holy tongue. Yiddish was the language of the people. And with the revival of Hebrew, with modern Hebrew around the birth of the State of Israel, that's a distinction that has largely been lost. But Yiddish was always the language associated with just the people, the family. One of its many nicknames is Mama Loshen, the mother tongue.
And you mentioned with Honey on the Page, a lot of these stories are sort of lesser known. The authors may have not sort of been given the credit that they were due. How did you start uncovering the stories? When did you come across them in your education and decide, hey, I should make a book about this?
So in 2013, I had two young children, and I had been teaching at Emory for 6 years and was regularly teaching a beginner's Yiddish language class. And I reflected back on my own experiences studying Spanish, Hebrew, and Arabic, and I realized that early in my language study, I had always been exposed to children's literature, which is a very reasonable thing to do with beginning language students. But in my Yiddish studies, that had never been the case. And I started wondering, well, is there any literature written for children in Yiddish? And it very quickly proved to be a kind of laughably ignorant question, because I discovered that not only did this literature exist, but that most of it had been digitized, that it was easily available to those who read Yiddish. And I thought the rest of the world really needs access to the treasures that are kind of lying buried in plain sight.
And you do have a lot of fascinating treasures that you uncover in this book. I want to talk about a couple of them. And in particular, what I love about the book is you not only have the Yiddish stories themselves translated into English, but you also have sort of biographies of who these authors and who these people were. So one of my favorites was Yonkev Pat, who wrote about the magic lion. Yonkev had a fascinating history in the Jewish workers' movement. Tell us a little bit about him.
That's right. So he was one of these people who were very involved in education and educational leadership. He goes from the classroom to a more administrative position fairly early, and he rises to a very high position in the one of the school networks that was both in the city of Vilnius, in what is now Lithuania, known in Yiddish as Vilna, and in Warsaw. And he wrote for adults, he wrote for leftist periodicals, but he also wrote for children. And he got very, very lucky. In 1938, he was part of a delegation of the Jewish workers' movement that was fundraising in the United States. And he was actually still in New York when the war broke out, and he decided to stay in a place of safety and refuge. And he was able eventually to bring his family over and to bring hundreds of educators and writers from the Yiddish school system to safety in the United States during the Holocaust. So he had a really extraordinary life. He continued to be very productive as an author, but he also really took up the work of memorialization after the war. So an extraordinary person, and he writes this really this really beautiful folk story called The Magic Lion.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about it. It's one of my favorite stories in the book. To set it up a little bit, you have this rabbi that needs to traverse across a desert, and he knows his journey is going to take him about a week. And Jewish law, on the day of the Sabbath, you are not supposed to exert energy. So he knows he is not supposed to continue walking that day. And his traveling party says, no way, we're not going to get stuck in the desert in the middle of the night. And so you have this rabbi stuck in the desert, and all of a sudden he sees a lion. What happens next?
So he sees this real, the story says, a real terrifying lion, the king of the jungle, who's taking long, quick lion steps right over to the rabbi. And he very quickly realizes that it might be his time to go. It might be his time to die. And if that happens, he will commend his soul to God and come what may. But because his fear is dispelled, he's able to kind of make the next right move, which is he's in the midst of his Sabbath meal, which consists of a piece of challah bread. And so he very instinctively breaks off a piece of the bread and offers it to the lion, who accepts it quite graciously. And they end up spending the entire Sabbath together as companions. And the rabbi engages in all of the sort of typical rituals of the Sabbath meals, the Sabbath prayers, reviewing that week's Torah portion in his mind. And throughout all of this, the lion is participating in his own leonine way alongside the rabbi.
Another interesting person you profile is the famous Yiddish playwright Shalom Ash. How did he bring Yiddish stories to the theater in New York? I thought his history was fascinating too.
Yes, so Shalom Ash is definitely one of the more celebrated and well-known names in the volume. And I include two of his stories. And he was so prolific that he really had multiple parallel careers going on. He was a playwright, as you mentioned. He was a novelist. He wrote for children. He wrote essays and occasional pieces for periodicals. And so I was able to include two of his stories for children. One is called A Village Saint, and it is about a boy who learns differently. Today we would say that he was a little bit neurodivergent, perhaps, around the time of his bar mitzvah. And all of the disappointment that his parents and his community have when he's not able to master the traditional body of knowledge that would be expected of him, but he is able to make a more direct connection with God, with the divine. And it's a connection that ends up being recognized by a holy rabbi in his community. And so there is a kind of belated recognition that other people have that this boy has a really special spirit that needs to be honored. So that's one of the stories. And then the other one is called The Magnet of Jerusalem, about a very wealthy man who thinks that he's doing everything right and has to engage in a very rigorous process of self-scrutiny to understand that even when it seems like you're doing everything right, there can sometimes still be room for growth.
Yeah, and I remember the first story really resonated with me in thinking about the different ways you can have relationships with God and with faith and sort of not imposing how one should practice it. And you got to see through this character, even through the neurological disability, his passion and interest in developing that relationship with God was not hindered or prevented because of that.
That's right. That's right. And actually, this story picks up on a Hasidic motif, a storytelling motif that comes out of the Jewish mystical movement of the 17th and 18th century Hasidism, which often involves a character who is able to either blow a penny whistle or whistle with his mouth in a way that arrests everybody's attention and makes a direct connection to God. And that's exactly what this boy does at the climactic moment when everyone is in synagogue praying on the high holidays and you could hear a pin drop, but all of a sudden he whistles and he breaks through the veil between God and the community.
Absolutely. I've been fascinated to read about, and I'm sure you're very knowledgeable of this, this resurgence of Yiddish culture among millennials across the country. I've read about clubs in New York where young people will meet and chat in Yiddish. There's even one in South Beach here in Miami. What's contributing to this resurgence of a language that you said has been around for hundreds of years, if not thousands?
That's right. So there was a time when the only story about Yiddish was decline and nostalgia and anxiety. But there were people throughout those decades when it seemed like, you know, the star of Yiddish was really falling. There were people who are still planting seeds for the next generation in the form of intensive language programs, translation programs to teach people how to translate. There was still theater. There were other things happening in the arts through what I think of as the lean decades. And now all of those seeds are flourishing. Yiddish is so hip among college age and slightly older young adults. It's incredible to watch because not very long ago, I was known as a young Yiddishist. Now I'm in my 40s and my students are doing incredible things with Yiddish culture.
You had mentioned in the story of Yonkev Pat, that's the case in other stories that are included in the book, this need to preserve the history following the Holocaust. And I'm wondering if we even have a sense of how many Yiddish artists and creators were lost in that genocide.
Well, too many, certainly. I'm glad that you drew attention to the biographical notes because they really do form a kind of parallel story to the children's tales. The biographical notes form this parallel account of the Jewish 20th century, and particularly the Eastern European Jewish 20th century. And some of my authors died in New York or Tel Aviv due to, you know, old age or the complications of later life, but too many of them were lost during the Holocaust in the Warsaw Ghetto, in the forests outside of Vilna, or in places unknown. And I actually would find it probably just a little too heartbreaking to try to count up what was lost, but certainly, you know, it can never be forgotten. And we also can really see, I think I've managed to reflect in the volume, how the project of writing a literature for Yiddish speaking children shifts after the Holocaust in the 1950s. And it really becomes a project of cultural preservation and consolidation. And so people go back to telling stories about the holidays because they want children growing up with Yiddish, even if they're not going to observe all of the holidays, they want them to be conversant with what the themes are, what the motifs and practices are. And so we see all kinds of efforts in the 50s and beyond to try to compensate for some of what was lost in the Holocaust.
And that was Sundial senior producer Chris Remington speaking with Miriam Udell, author of the new book, Honey on the Page. You can find more information on the book and more coverage of Passover this week. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for this Thursday, April 1st, 2021. Coming up next week on the show, Governor Ron DeSantis has signed into law the COVID liability bill, shielding companies and nursing homes from lawsuits connected to the pandemic. So if you've lost a loved one to the virus and you believe there was negligence, what actions can you take? We're going to hear from a South Florida attorney about possible steps. Plus, it's April, which means the start of the O Miami Poetry Festival. The festival is connecting children from Puerto Rico to Miami through a letter writing project, and we'll learn more about that. And a reminder, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we are reading Miami by author Joan Didion. The prolific author and journalist spent years in the Magic City back in the 1980s interviewing members of the Cuban exile community and learning the critical role that they played in shaping South Florida politics. Get your copy now, and then don't forget, go to Facebook, join the Sundial Book Club. Just look up Sundial Book Club. It's free to join. We'd love to have you. Always share with us your thoughts about the book, questions you may have about the book, and also tell us what else you're reading, because we'd love to know. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thank you so much for listening. This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. As always, stay safe, be good to each other, have a great Friday, have a great weekend. We'll be back live on Monday.